Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we are going to be talking with Emilio Viano, and he is the president of the International Society of Criminology. It's a group of professionals that come together to look at the problems with crime internationally. And they're looking at things like human trafficking. They're looking at, well, human trafficking at all different levels, whether it's sexual trafficking, work trafficking for work, trafficking organs. They're looking at crimes in many different areas. He also is a voting member of the steering committee for the World Bank on, it's called the Global Forum on Law, Justice, and Development. And it was a forum that was put together for the World Bank to be more conscious of the activities that they're doing and to think through more how it affects the local people and whether it's positive or negative, and not just looking at money and the development, which I thought was really interesting. So I wanted to talk to him about that. He also just recently had a trip where he visited Pope Francis at the Vatican and learned what Pope Francis thought was the most important elements that we need to be looking at from a crime standpoint. And he shares that with us. He had a really deep conversation with him on that. So I want to get into that interview now with Emilio Viano, but I want to tell you this is a two-part interview, and it's about an hour and a half long, and so it's split into two parts. So I hope you stay and watch both parts. So let's get into that interview now with Emilio Viano. Hi, Emilio. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm so glad that you decided to join us. I think what you do is such an important thing that we need in this world, and I'd really like to see where you're at and how you approach this and what world leaders are saying about this, because I think that, you know, what they say and how they contribute to it either helps or makes it worse. So to start off, can you tell us what the International Society of Criminology does and what your role there is?
Well, the International Society of Criminology is a professional association, and it is basically a network of professionals that work in the area of crime, delinquency, crime prevention, the criminal justice system, most of all and foremost to try to prevent crime from occurring, but then when unfortunately it takes place, to also assist in understanding why, what to do about it, how to proceed with the aftermath of crime, but both for the suspect, the accused, and the victim. And finally, to also make sure that our criminal justice system in whichever country works to perfection, if possible, in order to fight this blight that can seriously affect the fabric of society.
So why did you decide to get involved? What is your passion behind this?
Well, in part, it was started by the fact that when I was a student in New York, at New York University, especially at that time, there was considerable crime in downtown Manhattan, around NYU, in what is today the West Village, and in other parts of that area. And myself, I was affected, and many other students had obviously tales to tell about being mugged or having their apartment broken into, et cetera, et cetera. And that piqued my attention. Also, there were some stories by some of the female graduate students, at times going out on a date and trying to fight off that would be rapists, and being at times left behind by these men, leaving them somewhere and driving off. So all those things perked my attention on the fact that there was a lot of social disorder and suffering going around us, and we were already a privileged group of citizens. We were graduate students at a prestigious university in a big city, And still, there was a lot of victimization going on and very little reaction on the part of the community, on the part of the state. And that piqued my attention to become involved both on the side of the criminal, in the sense of understanding why people would commit crimes, would you know, get to that point, but also on the part of the victim. And especially there at the time, there was very little done in recognizing the impact of crime on the victim, the rights of the victim, the role of the victim in the criminal justice system, and also the aftermath of victimization on them, the primary victims, on their family and others, the secondary victims, and then what we call the re-victimization process, namely the justice system, at times the police, the district attorneys, the courts, doctors, re-victimizing the victim through their lack of sensitivity, through their importune questions, and through their using the victim mostly as a source of information, and then, you know, basically throwing them away, saying, you gave us the information, now go away. You know, we don't want to deal with you, we want to do our work. So I think that on both sides of the fence, I believed and felt that there was a lack of interest, and I became interested in this, and I decided to become active in what was called the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, that at the time was in New York City at 5th and 23rd Street, and now I believe they moved to San Francisco many years ago. And at that time, it was the only real organization seriously involved in studying these issues. And so I became very active in the National Council at the time.
Well, I think the re-victimization is such an important point, because a lot of people don't even want to come forward because they think that the system is going to victimize them maybe worse than what they just went through. Rape cases is a good example, where women go through those rape kits that they go through, and then thousands of them don't even get processed and just sit on the shelves. So what's the point of even, you know, I mean, what's the point of even going through that if it's not going to go anywhere anyways?
Sure. In a way, you know, that is the negative aspect of having some success. In other words, there has been advances in science that allow us to get DNA from, you know, various sources. The fact that there's been more pressure on police to use these kits, particularly with victims of rape, but then the lack of organization, laboratories, funds, and follow-up to process them. And so, yes, we collect all this evidence, which is, of course, already a step forward, but then we don't do anything about it, and we just store it away, and so it doesn't serve any purpose, or it doesn't help, you know, arrest anybody who might be continuing as a serial rapist to do this. And that is certainly a major problem that we still have today. Very little funds are allocated to clear this backlog, and of course there's also deterioration of the samples at times, and the dissatisfaction of the victims, feeling that they cooperated, they came forward, they provided the samples, but then nothing happened, no one contacted them, and there was no follow-up.
Well, do you ever get involved in war zones? Because we know that in war zones, people are so vulnerable, and so the crimes, it's like a crime haven. It's like in Louisiana after that big Hurricane Katrina, when there's so many desperate people, it became a crime haven there. And I suppose Chicago, there's parts of Chicago that are almost like war zones. It's like whenever there's people who are desperate in need, there becomes huge amounts of crime. So do you get involved in that?
Well, there is no question that what is happening, for instance, in the Middle East, or also in Central Africa, Northern Nigeria, Chad, with Boko Haram and the kidnapping of those hundreds of young women from girls' colleges and schools, have heightened our awareness. Plus, as for anything else, the growth of international instant communications that make us find out that in India cut off the fingers of his wife because he objected to her going to school at night. And so, since she didn't intend to stop, he just decided to cut off her fingers so she couldn't write anymore. Women being raped by men, at times dressed like women, waiting for them at night when they go outside to relieve themselves, and they take advantage of this, and so on and so forth. So certainly what is happening in the Middle East, in where our troops also are involved, and the fact that women in particular in these areas are treated very poorly, have very, very few rights, and then also the instant communications that allow us to really know what is going on around the world, not just in our immediate neighborhood, has made all of us more interested, aware, and concerned about the victimization and the enormous suffering that goes on, adding naturally to the enormous suffering that the war itself is generating, both on the sides of, let's say, Islamic terrorists, and also our intervention, because our bombs kill people just as much as ISIS, you know, munitions. So in that respect, we are all kind of part of this victimization on a mass scale. I have not been directly involved in these situations. I've not traveled to those areas in the capacity of working there, but we follow them through colleagues that we have, members of our society, and try to give them the support that we can, in the sense of encouraging them to continue their work, inviting them to our conferences, at times providing the funds for them to travel so that they can share their story. And I think that that is already something that we are doing to bring forth the real story of what is happening.
Did you get involved in the Palestinian issue? Because we know that over there in the Gaza Strip, it is such an inhumane situation that they have. Regardless of the politics, you know, I've talked to people on both sides of this. They're living in a very subhuman type situation. And there's that in and of itself is a major crime. They don't have water. They don't have, you know, food. They don't. It's just a very, very dire situation. Do you get involved in any of that and how to deal with some of these groups that are so poor, you know, have such a poor environment?
Well, I completely agree with you that Gaza in particular, as some people describe it, is the biggest open sky prison in the world. And there is no question that there is a lot of suffering there. Even the reconstruction of Gaza after the latest explosion of hostilities between Israel and Hamas in that area took place, and with apparently the Israelis, you know, slowing down the disbursement of funds and the help that has been sent to reconstruct hundreds, if not thousands, of buildings and structures that have been destroyed. And we all follow that with great concern, understanding, of course, that there are always two sides to the story and that there are different interests in play. It's very hard for us as a professional association, more of a scholarly and policy-making nature, to become directly involved with that, because we are not, like, let's say, Oxfam, Save the Children, Amnesty International, or any of these organizations that, like Doctors Without Frontiers, that go directly in those areas with a service that is affecting the population. We are more on the scholarly research and policymaking side, which is obviously a little more distant from that. Not to say that this is not important, because, for example, today, with all the metadata that we have, we can now take a look at enormous quantities of data and studies and come up, let's say, with a summary and with what we call evidence-based conclusion, and definitely hopefully make an impact. For example, one recent result of these studies is that it shows that poverty impacts, for example, the development of the brain of children. And often this has long-term consequences in the sense of impairing their judgment, impairing their maturation, impairing their impulse control, and therefore preparing many of them, or at least making them vulnerable, to becoming what we might call later on juvenile delinquents and then career criminals. So in a sense, that is the result of research to show empirically that poverty is not just something that happens that we should feel compassion for and give a little money to Catholic charities or whatever it might be, that it gives out some food or volunteer for the local soup kitchen, is that it impacts particularly children's development and their brain development, so that if there is poverty, we can anticipate an uptick of juvenile delinquency and eventually adult delinquency, because these people don't have the tools to control themselves, to understand and interpret situations as they should. I think that's an important argument in favor of fighting poverty seriously and not to abandon the efforts that times governments feel tempted to do, because the poor don't have big lobbying firms advocating for them. They don't have a big voice in Congress or the state legislature, and they are often disposable. And so they get neglected, and those are often the budgets that are cut the first. But that is very mistaken, because in the end, we will all pay for it. And look at what we are doing presently, you know, the call even by the federal government to increase police forces, to hire more, ICE agents, to distribute more military equipment to the police. All of this is costly, and in the end, it also impacts us. It impacts how we see the police and how the police see us.
Well, that's such a great point, because I did a series of shows on our foster care system, and there's a documentary out called Foster Shock. And what I learned is that these kids go through so much trauma in the system. And so when they're in the system, they say there's just another 8 years, 7 years, and they're going to be in the prison system. And so the system is creating a whole generation of criminals later on, because they're so shocked by the poor treatment. Over half of these kids in the system are sexually abused, and we aren't taking care of this base problem. And now we're just creating generation after generation of criminals. And now, but we're not taking care of the problem.
Well, yeah, as you know, this is also a Cinderella part of the system of welfare and of social services. Very often their funds are very limited. There are at times also social workers and child protection agents that don't do their job properly and don't investigate or don't perceive the seriousness of a situation. Or if they do, they don't see any other alternative than moving the children to somewhere else where it might happen again. And so it is certainly a field ripe for abuse, neglect, trauma for these children, and preparing them very often for a life of unhappiness personally as human beings, and also at times for becoming indeed criminals, because they feel so separated, you know, unhinged, not connected through love, affection, maternal, paternal care, someone who really cares for them and wants them to succeed, and are thrown into the world with very little preparation. And if I may make a comment, for instance, we read these days of this mother near Cleveland that was stopped by the police, and they found that she didn't have a driver's license. And then it turns out that she is an undocumented immigrant, and she has already been deported in a few days, it just happened last week, to Mexico, and leaves behind four children.
Oh.
Now, is that really what is in our interest? To have now four children, basically from elementary school to high school, and their father left bereft to their mother, and we can easily understand what is going to, or what could happen with the lack of a mother present, the father having obviously to go to work to provide for them, and these kids growing up without much supervision. which often leads to tremendous mischief, but also the lack of guidance, the lack of a maternal love and interest and support and counsel and advice. And yes, she did violate the law. She was undocumented. But in applying the law, we have to take into account mitigating factors to start with, and then also our own long-term interest. What is our interest to have these four kids now running around without supervision when they come home from school, there is nobody there, and soon enough getting into all sorts of mischief from sexuality to pranks to maybe bullying to who knows what else. And then we are left with the pieces. We are left with the juvenile delinquents. And then we have to spend time, money, personnel, police, courts, youth officers, juvenile homes, and so on and so forth. And the times never stop the cycle of criminality for the rest of their lives. And so I think that there too, there are short-sighted policies and application of the law.
Well, it seems that every policy that we have, there are good things that why it's put in place, but it's always a little more complicated. So we have to be smarter and actually have a little bit of freedom for somebody who's smarter, who can work through the details to make sure that the problem is there's always creeps in the system that take advantage of people and things and loopholes. It's so hard to come up with rules that work for the benefit of all of society.
Certainly. But as in any other transaction in our lives, we have to take into account all the variables. If we are buying something, maybe this is, for example, is typical season for car sales because the new models are arriving and therefore the dealers want to get rid of their cars. If you are in buying a car, you are weighing many, many different factors. The price is not the only factor. Is maybe the need of the consumption of gasoline, or you know, how elegant it is, or if you like the color, or whatever. And you balance if there is a loan, how much, what is the interest rate. And the same here. For example, if this woman had been a single person that only had herself, maybe even not even a dog to take care of, I can understand that the system might say, go back home. You are actually, you know, your departure is not affecting much in this country. But if it is a mother of four, I think that the system should say, wait a minute, what are we doing here? What are we setting ourselves up for by expelling such a person that plays a pivotal role in growing four U.S. citizens that will stay here and we will have to deal with them in the future? So as an example, no? If it is a single person, male or female, you can say, fine, you know, you broke the law, you shouldn't be here, even though you have committed no other crimes, that just driving without a license, and go home. But if it is someone that is going to raise a family, then who is going to do it? As you were saying, what about the foster system? It doesn't work, and it causes more victimization and alienation and mental problems than anything else. So you are absolutely right. There is always two sides even more to any story. But as in our own transaction, buying a house, where it is located, how good the schools are, how much it costs, how easy it is to get a loan, blah, blah, blah. We all take many factors into account. Buying a house is not the same for everybody. On the contrary, almost every purchase is a very personal decision, taking into account many variables. And the same here, too. If we want to apply the law, we cannot just have, you know, the one-cutter type of approach that you know, one model, you know, applies to all. We have to take into account the situation.
Well, let's talk about a very serious problem of human trafficking. And you look at our child welfare system, and it's a prime target for human trafficking. You look at places like Haiti, that's a prime target for human trafficking. In fact, it's such a great target for human trafficking that people are, you know, that's where the conspiracy theories start to form, where people think they are purposely keeping it like that because human trafficking is so lucrative and it's such a great place to be able to get your victims. What do you do, or how do you approach that problem?
Well, trafficking is certainly a major problem of our contemporary life. It is nothing new. It has taken place for centuries and for millennia. Slavery was certainly a form of trafficking, and we certainly were involved in that, not ourselves directly, but in the history of the country and many other countries in the hemisphere, including Brazil and other Latin American countries and many European countries up to a point. And so it is nothing new, but it has grown surprisingly exponentially. We would have thought that with all our being more civilized, with the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, with all the UN and governmental agencies that are controlling and supervising and protecting vulnerable people in the world, this should be difficult to do. But on the contrary, it has indeed increased enormously. And ironically, I think it's a case study of good things that generate bad things. The good things are, well, there is increasing wealth in the world. More and more people are living over the subsistence level. And while for us it may not be that dramatic, there are fewer and fewer people that subsist on very little money every day. So the world is getting richer, let's say, that way. And certainly in some cases, enormous number of people are becoming richer. Think of what we perceive China to be and how explosive the growth of the middle class and very wealthy people has been there, and the same also in countries like India and others. So there is the positive aspect, there is more wealth. But with more wealth, very often also, we have the growth in certain types of crime. Why? Because many people for centuries wanted certain goods that were forbidden, and they were also unattainable for them. They were unattainable, for example, financially. They couldn't afford them. And what other good things have happened that make crime grow? For example, the ease and the speed of transportation. Today, you know, you can be in the middle of Nigeria, and with a couple of connections or maybe a direct flight, you can arrive to New York, Washington, San Francisco the same day, which was totally impossible just 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, when you most likely have to come by boat, and it would take you just from Europe to New York, it would be 10 to 11 days. Today we can come back, you know, after lunch in Paris and be home for dinner in Washington or New York. So the fact that there is this ease of transportation also makes trafficking obviously much more easy, because you can move people very quickly. And who knows how many times we have sat next to somebody on an airplane who was being trafficked, and we didn't know it, of course, unless we are trained to perceive certain behavioral traits of this person. But I cannot be excluded that for those of us who travel a lot, we may have been either sitting next or in the same section of the airplane where there may be more than one person being transported for evil purposes from one place to another. And then what other things are favoring trafficking? Globalization. Currencies that are world currencies, like the dollar, the euro, and others, and the demand for human services that people wanted but were not attainable or were and still are illegal. For example, how many people maybe think of vacation of a sexual nature, and so traveling to certain countries where you can have your vacation, but a vacation where, I hate to use the word, you can rent a human being for your sexual pleasure for a week, for a month, whatever you may want, as long as you pay. And where do these people come from? Well, they often come from poorer countries, and they can be transported very easily, and the money is being changing hands, and people are getting what they want. And this also applies also to, let's say, all the trafficking in ivory, the trafficking in other animal, fauna, flora, that is per se forbidden, because people desire these goods have the money to buy them, and there is the globalized system of transportation, exportation that makes it possible. Let me give you an example. For example, the famous shark fin soup. The shark fin soup is a staple of high Chinese cuisine. For centuries, it was extremely expensive, particularly in the middle of China, far away from the ocean. It was only afforded by very wealthy people that would offer it to their guests on the occasion of a wedding or of a promotion or a big celebration. And it cost a lot of money. Now, many Chinese have enough money to buy shark fin soup, and they do it as a sign of status, like ordering a filet mignon for some people when until yesterday they could only go to McDonald's. So fine, they order it. But then where do the fins come from? From the sharks. And how many of them are there? Well, every shark has only two main fins. So you have to kill literally millions of sharks to produce enough fins to then export to China or other countries and produce this coveted soup. So now in some places, sharks are an endangered species, because they are captured exclusively for the fins that are cut and the animal thrown back into the water to die. So I'm giving a number of examples to show that while we are living better, we have more money, we have better health, we have better medical care, we also can indulge in things, legal or illegal, that before were off limit to most people for many reasons. First, because of poverty, they couldn't afford it. Secondly, because it didn't get to their area and they couldn't easily travel, sex tourism, for example. And thirdly, because there wasn't the globalization that facilitates all of this through communication, movement of money, the international currencies, particularly the dollar, the euro, and that makes everything easier. So trafficking has grown exponentially. And I would like to stress, because I think it's very important, most people think of trafficking only in terms of sex work. And they think of women from the Dominican Republic going to Switzerland under the pretense of being waitresses and then being forced to prostitute themselves and so on and so forth. But trafficking is mostly for completely legal work, for which people don't want to pay the proper wages and obtain the proper permits. So in construction, there is indeed those who accuse the men of the Arab Emirates to build their fantastic buildings on the back of trafficked people who get very little pay, are treated in horrible ways, just really slaves of their employers. They cannot leave unless they have the approval of their employer. They often are not paid. They live in squalid situations, and so on and so forth. So it's important to stress that the trafficking is not just for illegal activities, particularly prostitution. It is also for legal activities, and it is actually the major part of it. But we don't think of it. We don't perceive it. And it might be taking place right now. It's summer, and lots of strawberries and cherries and watermelons are being harvested, and corn. And how many of these people may be trafficked, may be receiving very little pay, and have basically be unheard, mistreated, denied medical care, sexually assaulted if they want to, and so on and so forth. So trafficking is a major problem, but it is not just the problem that many people perceive. It's very invasive and insidious, because it goes into legitimate activities, and it is fueled by, well, desire for earning a lot of money. If I can hire, I have a farm and we are harvesting apples soon enough. If I can hire 20 people and pay them almost nothing, I'm ahead of my neighbor that might be paying $15 an hour. So there is that motivation, right, of earning and spending very little on the human capital. And that is often, justified by competition, by the fact that if we don't do it, then we lose out to others, and so on and so forth. So it is a very complicated issue that very often it is also covered by some hypocrisy. For example, there are a lot of calls right now by our federal government to only, buy American, hire American. But then here in Virginia, according to a local magazine called the Washingtonian, the president in Trump winery has just hired 87 non-American workers to come in for harvesting season. And apparently 76 for his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida as waiters, bartenders, and so on and so forth.
Is it hard, though, to hire regular American citizens to do these jobs because they don't want to?
Well, that is the normal excuse given. But let's face it, how many normal red-blooded Americans pump gas when we stop for gas? How many of them are packing our groceries at Safeway or Giant or Whole Foods or wherever you go? In other words, it's a cheap excuse. What is missing is proper salary. Why do you think that Trump Winery wants 87 non-U.S. people to harvest grapes this coming fall? Because they pay them very little. If you pay people $15, $20 an hour, I bet you there are plenty of Americans who would go there with scissors and cut grapes.
So the supply and demand would work if we would allow it to work.
And also if we had a more just system of repartition, of sharing wealth. In other words, as I said, if you want to pay people only $2, $3 an hour, then you don't find any Americans to do it, or very few. Then you bring people in from desperate situation for whom even that is better than zero. But if you pay people a decent salary, then you would get local people to take those jobs, and they need them. These are desperate people, even in our country. It's not fun to be sitting all day in a self-gas station to watch those gas pumps and being paid probably absolutely the minimum wage. It's not fun. People like jobs. They like to have a feeling of ownership and contribution, but very often we don't want to pay them. And therefore, of course, people don't come and don't show up. And then the excuse is, oh, we cannot get Americans, so we have to bring in other people. And as you know, this is particularly serious when it comes to higher paying jobs like software developers, where correctly, it is true that very often bringing in people, let's say from India, as it is typically done, or similar countries, you can bring in somebody and pay them a fraction of what you would pay an American, but still pay them decently by their own standards. And of course, make a pile of money. And so what happens? That our youth who train to be software writers and developers graduate, and then they don't find any jobs.
Yeah, they can't find a job. The competition is too high.
They cannot find a job, or they find it, but it is not paying enough for them to live. It's one thing to live in an apartment with eight other guys, and away from your family and eating, you know, some rice every night. Is another thing to be somebody living in this country who wants to, or maybe be married, have children, have invested in his education, and expects a return. And that is where, indeed, there is injustice also towards our fellow Americans, that very often to justify great earnings, and I happen to know some numbers because some of my law students are involved on the legal side in these transactions, so bringing in software writers from South Asia to the Washington area and elsewhere. And the earnings are fantastic. And of course, we allow it in a way. And so these are the injustices. It is the fact that there is no equity in sharing the wealth of the country.
Well, let's talk about human trafficking a little bit more, because I think your concept that we've had, well, it's fact that we've advanced, like with organ trafficking, we've gotten to the point where we're really good at doing organ transplants, and people have more wealth, and there's a much higher demand because people are living longer, because other diseases are taking are being taken care of. So people are needing organs more, and so there's a much higher demand in the black market for organs. So this organ trafficking has become pretty explosive. And places like Haiti and places that are poor and vulnerable are being trafficked for their organs. And hospitals are involved. And I've even had tip-offs from people that orphanages are actually people, kids are actually grown for their organs. Do you hear about that? And what do you think of that?
Well, I completely agree with you that this is another big aspect of trafficking, and there are even others. It is a big field. And the organ trafficking is an enormous market where the earnings are exceptionally high, and that what makes it worthwhile.
It's one of the largest black markets. My son did a big report in school on it, and that was the finding, is that this is one of the largest black markets that exist.
Of course. And again, as I was saying before, ironically, this is in part made possible by the advances we have in transportation. You can move a kidney from the Middle East or to South Asia, to London, or to Tokyo, or to San Francisco within a day. With DHL or FedEx, you can get it there very, very quickly. So in a way, it is again our advances in transportation, refrigeration, way of handling these organs, and medical advances in conserving them and implanting them that have made it much more possible to do it, plus the fact that there are more people with money who say, I need a new kidney, and I'm willing to pay $25,000-$50,000 for you to do it for me. So again, I go back to my previous statement that ironically, the fact that we are wealthier, that there is faster communication, that there is better refrigeration, that there are advances in medicine, also have this downside that now, if we have money, we can say, get me a kidney. And if it means attracting somebody in Karachi, Pakistan, under false pretenses, drugging them, as they say they do at times, cutting them up and getting their kidney and sending it up DHL to Philadelphia or wherever, it can be done, and it is done. And these persons at times are not even paid because they are basically captured, drugged, operated upon, and then abandoned. Those who get some money are already lucky. There are many who are not, and you're right that there is also the whole issue of children and younger people that are being kind of farmed for this. Now, this is a more difficult area to get into because one can be accused easily of a conspiracy theory and of thinking, you know, that the whole world is rife with this type of shenanigans. Think about the recent awareness that we have, developed about pedophilia, pederasts, child pornography, even at the highest levels of some governments. There is a whole immense field out there that is extremely lucrative, and where it is not just a question of pictures, it is a question of videos with rapes of these children, and also at times it is said even snuffing their life away and mistreating and torturing sadistically these young bodies. So as you can see, the idea of trafficking, the idea of the wealth, the idea of technology that facilitates this is presenting great challenges for us. We all like to think that we live in a more civilized world, and we are, of course, that we are more aware of human rights, true. But then look, for example, politically, worldwide, we are having a trend now towards authoritarian governments. We see it in typical countries like, well, Turkey is one of the latest examples. But then there are some Eastern European countries, Poland, for example, and others that are also becoming rather authoritarian. There are some who might argue that even our own current government has an authoritarian streak. And there is this admiration for Putin, which is certainly not a Democrat or someone apparently respecting human rights very much. And then there are dictators that are there for decades. In Zimbabwe, Mugabe has been there 47 years. And now we see this evolving in Venezuela with Maduro and many other parts of the world where there is more authoritarian um, there is always this challenge, the challenge of fighting for human rights, fighting for justice, fighting for equity in the sharing of wealth, which is a big topic even in our country. Today, they announced, of course, that we have created enormous amount of new jobs, but no one talks about at what salary level. I remember a joke many years ago when another president of ours boasted that he had created so many hundreds of thousands of jobs, and someone on a 11 o'clock at night a talk show said, yeah, and I have six of them. In other words, in order to make it, I have to work one, two, three, four, five jobs if I want to eat. So creating jobs is becoming now a panacea to say, oh, we are so successful. Wait a minute. How much do they pay? And that is really also very important. But to go back to your point, it is very well taken. All this issue of the organ trafficking is only going to increase, because there are already those who say that soon we might be able to even transplant brains. And of course, that raises interesting questions. You know, if you receive someone else's brain, who are you? Are you you or that person? There are many interesting facets.
Transplant an older person's brain into a young, healthy body.
No, the opposite. That an older person that has plenty of money and says, I am 80 or 90 and I want to live another 20, 30 years and I have a tumor, give me a new brain. Just as today we can transplant a heart or a liver or a kidney, there are those who say that soon we may be able to implant new brains so that the person can beat brain cancer.
I have no idea what that will generate. It doesn't seem like you're going to be you anymore.
But that's interesting, because it will help us in a way really tackle that issue. You know, who are we? Where is the we, you or me? Where is Sarah? Where is it? Where is she located in the body, in the brain? But that instinctively, of course, we say, yeah, it's up here. That is Emilio or there, which is Sarah.
Maybe not.
Is it really so? We don't know.
It could just be an organ. Yeah.
And exactly so how they see it. But just imagine, you know, how these advances can then prey on poorer people, on people that are ignorant, on people who are desperate. Just think of all the young women who are sold normally for marriage.
Well, and that's why it's hard not to see certain areas being that where they could solve certain problems, or people go in there trying to solve problems and they can't get it done, or there's something weird going on. And you can see why it works in their benefit to keep it bad. You know, sometimes you think some of these conspiracy theories might have something behind it, because the market is so lucrative.
Yeah. Well, let me give you an example, which I think it is reasonable. For example, we know that there are indeed many women who go from certain countries, let's say here in Central America, even Brazil, Caribbean countries, to Europe or to Japan or to wealthier countries for, let's say, sex work. Now, this has been going on for decades. And some of these women from time to time may return back to their village and show off their wealth, which might even encourage other women. And they may come back as recruiters saying, look, you know, I have a car, I have these beautiful clothes, I have this gold ring, I have this apartment in Geneva or wherever. Come join me. You know, this is a great line of work. But are you telling me that the governments of these countries don't know when these women show up at the airport and say, I'm going to Switzerland, I'm going to Tokyo, I'm going to New York, what they are up to? They often do. Just as when you remember, we had that invasion, so to speak, between quotation marks, of young people from Central America. Now, their governments didn't know that it was going on. There was no border. There was no border guards to stop them and saying, hey, kid, you are 10 years old. What are you doing on this train? What are you doing on this truck? Go back home to your mom. They didn't. Why? Because these governments benefit from these people leaving for many reasons. first reason is that eventually they will send back some money. And the so-called remessas, or money sent back by immigrants, is one of the biggest sources of income for many countries in the world. You will be surprised. It's the third source of income in Mexico. It is often the first or second source of income in many Central American countries. So we are talking about billions of dollars being sent with the blood and sacrifice and tears. I admire them because they are paid so little, but these people are able to send back billions to their countries. And that's why you see so many money transfer machinery in Latino, you know, groceries in humble neighborhoods across the country, because people go there to send their $200 back to mom, back home, or to their wife, or their parents. Okay? So these governments love it because that is what allows what? Building new homes, buying new cars, buying better food, investing in the country, starting businesses there. So these governments, without doing anything much, receive this money from the outside that benefits them then through taxes and through increasing wealth and so on and so forth. So one can surmise, and I'm not accusing anyone in particular, that these countries know very well what is going on. And even more so, remember all those young people who came in that famous, you know, wave of refugees from Central America to the US just a couple of years ago. I'm sure you remember. Well, any one of them is another seat in school that I don't have to build, that I don't have to provide. It is another soccer player for whom I don't have to provide a soccer field. It is another young man that I don't have to train for employment. You follow me? In other words, there is at times, without going to conspiracy, this welcoming of the emigration. And it was welcomed in Europe, from Spain to Germany, to Poland, to Ireland, to Italy. Those governments welcomed these people living for the US, for Brazil, for other parts of the new hemisphere, because it took pressure off of them. And it is still going on today. So there is a lot of double play. There is a lot of hypocrisy in all of this, because there are real gains to be made, and there is also less pressure. If I don't have all these young people growing up here that are growing up in the US or in Italy or in Sweden, and they send back money, what more can I dream of?
Yeah, it's a great situation.
Okay.